Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as the Africa Jesuit AIDS Network marks its 8th anniversary, the new coordinator describes the challenges ahead. And stay tuned for episode 41 of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, as we find out more about the prisoner in the Vatican. Seed planted in Kenya over 8 years ago has now taken root and spread its branches to countries across the African continent, bringing new hope to those infected or affected by HIV/AIDS. The African Jesuit AIDS Network, or AJAN, was officially founded on June 21, 2002, by the Jesuit superiors of Africa and Madagascar, encouraging religious to accompany those living with the pandemic and to develop a holistic response appropriate for the different local circumstances. A 16th century Jesuit saint and a Congolese midwife murdered in 1964 were named as the two spiritual patrons of the network. Saint Aloysius Gonzaga, whose feast day falls on June the 21st, was a young Italian nobleman who renounced his life of luxury to become a priest and give his life caring for victims of a deadly plague. He died in Rome in 1591, aged just 23. The other patron is Blessed Anuarita Nengapeta, a young sister of the Holy Family who worked as a midwife and was murdered for resisting the sexual demands of a rebel leader in Congo in 1964. Their courageous examples continue to inspire the vision and ministry of the many Jesuits who are now involved with the network, recently described by an independent report as being resourceful and responsive to the needs and communities affected by the disease.
We gave room to the pastoral counseling, which includes psychosocial counseling for the psychological dimension. Someone who knows that he is living with the virus cannot be at peace with him, with the society, with God sometimes.
Jesuit Father Patean Mombe from the Central African Republic has just taken over from Father Michael Cherney as the new AJAN coordinator. Before heading the Nairobi-based network, he worked with young men and women at an educational centre in Lomé, Togo, teaching them about HIV awareness and prevention. Father Patean came to Vatican Radio to talk to us about his vision for the future and the specific cultural challenges facing all those fighting the pandemic in Africa today.
We have been working on all fronts. We did not select a particular group. It's important for an effectiveness to have both areas and to work with men and give them, young men, to teach them a certain vision of themselves and the women. And the other way around too, in a context like Togo, many African countries, women are more often being subject to poverty and so on, kind of involved in certain practice of sex work, which is not explicit and so on, but which is there, like women selling their body in order to have access to any goods or needs or to face their needs and so on. So we have this challenge, and we try to do our best to give them another alternatives, to give them another vision of another approach, how to handle this situation and be on the safe side.
That is particularly difficult, though, the situations where women have nothing to give, and this seems to be a way in which they can afford to feed their families or to provide for themselves.
For sure, it's not easy to have, let's say, a single mother who has nothing to live or to do something else than to sell her body to feed her children and so on. And in many places, only not young girls, but also women, and widows, all these stuff, sometimes they are faced with some situation, economical situation, which kind of expose them to this type of attitude. Yet, we try to give, or we are giving, or working hard to provide, what I'll say, a type of service which is relevant for that, which is giving them this possibility or chance to run income-generating activities. So we organized, for instance, last year with the help of a nun in Benin, Sister Justine. We organized a training to train some of the women on how to produce fabric, how to produce soap, how to produce different elements that they can sell. Okay, when I was running the Loyola Hope Center in Lomé, I was struggling to get money in order to give as a loan to women so that they can have, I pass through microfinance institution and help them have an income-generating activity that can help them respond to their needs and face the economical challenge of their life. So this approach is important, is relevant, is fruitful, yet fewer people or institutions who are willing to finance that, and it's just unfortunate. I don't think the solution is promoting condom and encouraging them to continue by selling body, but give them the chance to live in a dignifying way.
When you're talking about working with people who are already infected, of course, testing and diagnosis is the first crucial step to provide the care that they need. Mm-hmm. And yet it's still a source of great shame, isn't it, in many places? How much are you overcoming this prejudice and being able to convince people to get tested?
Yeah. Till today, for instance, when a woman would say to his husband, I need to go for HIV testing, the first reflection would be, why are you willing to go? Did you do something? You should be unfaithful and so on. This temptation to accuse, basically, men accusing women of being unfaithful. That's why they would go for HIV testing. But to help people or to encourage people to integrate it, we organize activities in the neighborhood. Like when we are reaching November, that's close to World AIDS Day, we organize public awareness activities in various places where we explain to people how getting HIV tested today is important. Since we live in a world with HIV and AIDS, we need to know our status, and the one who knows his status sooner can take good care of himself and live longer and so on. So we have activities to encourage people to do that. So when we do that, people come. Every World AIDS Day or the week before, we offer free access to HIV testing. We had to reduce the price first, and the number of people increased when we reduced the price. And when we organize free activity, people come a lot to attend. So it helps, move forward this barrier. And I guess I think today is not anymore a barrier. But the problem is, which is affecting our strategies today, is basically at the level of prevention of mother to child transmission. At this level, the strategy so far has been to have any pregnant woman being tested. And what we observe basically in rural areas, gave training in rural areas in Togo. What we discover from these practices is that sometimes a woman who goes, because she's pregnant, she goes for the test, and she's tested positive, she needs to open up to her husband. So when she does that, the reaction from the man is to chase her away, okay, from the house without any means to care for the child, okay? And he would accuse her of being unfaithful and so on. Although the man would be actually the one who would have infected the wife. So this situation where women are exposed to a very vulnerable situation makes that they are not open or ready to go for the test. So right now I'm working on a project which I would like to have developed at the level of the assistance in various Jesuit projects to open a room or to offer a room or offer a service that would target not only pregnant women, but pregnant women with their husbands, to have them both coming together out of the medical context, because in medical context, so there are so many people, sometimes the work is done in certain limits and so on. We would like to put on our charisma or sense of cura personalis, working every person where he is, to develop this approach which consists in working with couples or each member of the couples, offering them the service of pre-test counseling and helping them to understand all the stakes that go with the testing and the level of the family and what is important and so on, in order to prepare both couples to accept any result that would come and to learn to live together, whatever the result could be. And I think if we do that, this approach would kind of reduce situation whereby women are chased away because of their sero status, and would have more people or more couples or families having access to the test and preventing the infection from the children.
Because giving ARVs to pregnant women can effectively, can't it, stop the child being born with the disease?
Yeah, sure. There are evidence in this sense. At the medical level, there have been a lot of research which has been done. And today we know that HIV-AIDS women who receive from the 6 month of pregnancy antiretroviral drugs would kind of have less chance to transmit the infection to his new child born. So it's effective and it should be promoted. So far in Africa, the response is still very low as compared to the needs, but yet it's there and it needs to be promoted basically in this context of universal access.
You mentioned also counselling services for people who are suffering already from full-blown AIDS and so on. Tell us a bit more about your work in that field.
Yeah, I have some very interesting experience actually in that sense. In Lomé, I was directed to someone who was infected and was spending his time kind of spreading the virus around himself, okay?
So by sleeping with other people?
Dating with men, sleeping with them and so on, without revealing his status and making sure that he can expose them or infect them. That was the target. The aim was to infect as many people as much as possible. Such a person, I mean, he got the information about his status in a context whereby he was not prepared to accept the result and to live positively with it. He's making a mistake by getting involved in such a type of life, which is going to kind of push him towards, he's increasing his chance of morbidity, exposing himself to death as he's involved in a certain behavior, like spreading the virus around himself, and at the same time, endangering people's life. So when I got in touch with that person, slowly I tried to establish a good relationship with him and tried to help him look at the reality and see the possibilities, because actually was affected by the idea of AIDS or having HIV equals having AIDS. The first thing is to tell him having HIV, one thing is to have HIV, another thing is to have AIDS. Okay, so he can work, he can live in such a way that he would maybe live longer with the virus without undergoing the full-blown AIDS. And so in the communication, a kind of a trustful relationship, I've been able to help him accept his situation and move forward. There are many situations like that. We have another situation with a discordant couple. One of the lady I was kind of caring for was infected, and her husband, no. And she told him about when they were dating. He says, no way, I mean, no problem, we can use condom and so on. So one day, I mean, that was the case, they went to meet with a doctor who advised them to use condom consistently, told them how to use it and everything, and they invited the man to do the test once in a while, I mean, very often. So he did so many times, it was okay, until that day where himself, it turned out to be positive. And he was very revolted, as if he was not he was not expecting such a situation. So when it happened, he was really revolted and he was just refusing to eat. He was depressed and, he stopped doing anything and so on. So his wife came to me and explained to me the situation, and then tried to establish a relation with him and help him accept the situation. And today he's a happy man, he's working. So counseling is very important for people basically who are infected, because it helps them integrate their status, it helps them retrieve hope and kind of move forward beyond the picture. HIV equals AIDS. It's not the same thing, and they have to learn through counselling, and this is very important.
Counselling together with the drugs when and where they're available, but it's still very much the case that in Africa there is not anything like universal access, is there?
Yes, we are still far, 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 very far from the universal access. We still have in Africa a great number of people on the waiting list of antiretroviral drugs, and I think if today, AIDS may appear to people as a less emergency issue. This issue of access to antiretroviral drugs or others, it should be of first concern. For sure, I mean, I've been in touch with institutions where they have at least 400, 500 people. That's one out of 3% of the patients they're working with who are in need of the drugs, but that could not have access to it because it's not there for them. So we still have a long way to go. And we need also to improve our response in a context like Africa. Many countries in Africa, we just have access to the, you know, some simple antiretroviral drugs with, I would say, strong side effects as compared to others today, which are available on the market that also have a very good result. And all the context in which these drugs are provided is still poor. That's really, I mean, it's not relevant. For instance, if you go in Europe today, you can have testing that will tell you whether this antiretroviral drugs is working in this person or not. In Africa, we don't have this. So far, we don't have access to these type of testing, which are important. Let me share, for instance, the experience I had in Togo. When I got there, the country was suspended from global funds. So there was a time the government was not able to provide antiretroviral drugs. For a month, people could not have access to it. Sometimes 2 months, there was a time even 3 months they had to go in the street and to protest. So we have people who are on the drug, which they are called to take on a daily basis, who are forced, in spite of their goodwill, to interrupt the treatment. And this not only one time, two times, but so many times. In this type of context, normally we have this, what we call resistance to the drug. Okay, meaning someone who has been kind of interrupting his treatment may develop some strain of HIV, would resist to the drug, and would not be affected by it. So far, Togo, I mean, this year is going to come to happen, but Togo at that time did not have PCR, a machine to detect the viral load and the quantity of virus in the body of a person to know whether it has reduced to an undetectable level, which is the goal when we take antiretroviral drugs, or not. We don't have anything to assess the impact of this treatment. So people are living, continuing to take this drug. Sometimes it's not working on them, it's not effective, but we don't have a means to assess it. This is something which is not normally acceptable to this point after close to 30 years of a fight against AIDS. So we need also make access to these medical analysis to assess the impact of the therapy and to make sure that those who are on these drugs can also are getting a good response. If needed, they can have access to new drugs that could kind of improve the response. In this context, that we would have people in better condition, also reduce, I guess, the HIV infection spread.
So finally, you're facing a huge amount of challenges, as you rightly say.
Really.
What, if you had to summarise in a few words your vision for the future of the Jesuit AIDS Network, what would it be?
Okay. As you can discover through our sharing, we have various areas in which we intervene. I would like to build a strong expertise around each type of intervention to gather those who are doing something and kind of grasp the best practices and spread it in the network and even beyond the network. And I would like to fight, okay, so that we don't have just cheap solution at the level of prevention, at the level of care, at the level of capacity building, but we have what we need to have a real impact, to be effective in the context of AIDS.
Thanks there to Father Patean Mombe from the Central African Republic, the new coordinator of the Africa Jesuit AIDS Network. And now we present the next part of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, looking at the people and places that made up the history of the Vatican. Episode 41 is entitled The Prisoner in the Vatican.
The Napoleonic era had come and gone. The French Revolution was already history, but the ripples were still forming. And as the 19th century advanced, the nationalist movements gathered momentum.
Throughout the European continent, there was unrest and discontent. In France, empires and republics followed each other in dizzy succession. Then, in 1848, revolution flared in Paris, Milan, Berlin, Vienna, Prague, Budapest.
Massive emigration to America followed the Irish potato famine, which had left nearly a million dead, while for England, under Victoria, it was a time of stability at home, expansion abroad, the cult of family life, and an empire on which the sun never set.
Colonialism was in its heyday. After the discoveries of explorers Livingstone, Speke, and Burton, the scramble for Africa began.
The world was shrinking. Everywhere communications were improving. People read in their papers of the Crimean War with its tragic heroic charge of the Light Brigade and the heroine of the hour, Florence Nightingale. The Indian Mutiny, Garibaldi and his red shirts, the American Civil War and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. In Russia, the liberation of the serfs.
In 1848, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels published their Communist Manifesto, and the first Convention of Women's Rights was held in New York. A decade later, Orthodox Christians were shaken by the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species.
Inventions reflected the domestic emphasis of the age, the sewing machine and the safety pin, the refrigerator, the washing machine and the lawnmower. From the United States came a strange substance called chewing gum.
Morse invented the electric telegraph, Bell the telephone, Edison and Swan produced the first successful electric lights. More menacingly, barbed wire came into use. And in 1866, a man named Alfred Nobel invented dynamite.
The musical world was enchanted by the operas of Rossini and Wagner and the piano music of Liszt and Schumann. From France came the beginnings of the Impressionist school of art, Pizarro, Degas, Cézanne.
People were reading the novels of Victor Hugo, Charles Dickens, George Eliot, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, the poems of Baudelaire, of Tennyson and Browning, the plays of Ibsen.
From America came the horror stories of Edgar Allan Poe, the humorist Mark Twain, and Melville's Moby Dick, and the strange new poetry of Walt Whitman.
For the Pope in Rome, the revolutions of the mid-19th century were a warning of things to come. It was the end of a lifestyle. The temporal power of the papacy had become an anachronism.
By one of those curious tricks of fate, the last pope to reign over the Papal States was born in them himself.
Pius IX was elected pope in 1846. A popular choice, and known for his liberal sympathies, he was idolized by Italian nationalists, who dreamed of a federation with the pope at its head. But Pius was first and foremost a man of religion, and was not prepared to collaborate with extremists such as Mazzini and Garibaldi. On the 29th of April 1848, the pope made his position clear. He issued a statement declaring that it was not for him to preside over a united Italy, nor was it right for a pope to go to war.
Events now moved quickly. The prime minister appointed by Pius was assassinated, and in no time at all, Rome was in turmoil. Pius fled the city disguised as an ordinary priest and took refuge in Gaeta in the kingdom of Naples.
The Roman Republic lasted 8 months. By the end of July 1849, the French had taken the city, and the following spring the Pope returned under French escort and took up residence in the Vatican.
During his exile, Pius had not been idle. He wrote to the bishops of the world asking their opinion on the Church's teaching that the Virgin Mary had been conceived immaculate. The replies were favourable, and Pius decided to declare it an article of faith. This he did on December the 8th, 1854.
For a decade after the Pope's return to Rome, the Papal States were left in relative peace. But in the northern kingdom of Piedmont, a man named Cavour was working tirelessly towards the unification of Italy. In 1860, papal troops were defeated by the Piedmontese at Castelfidardo in the Marches. By the end of the year, all the Papal States had been occupied, except for an area around Rome.
In 1861, the Kingdom of Italy was proclaimed. That same year, on Monday the 1st of July, the first issue of a newspaper, described as political moral, appeared. Its name, the Osservatore Romano.
On the morning of September the 19th, 1870, the Pope said high pontifical mass in the presence of all the foreign diplomats accredited to his court. Afterwards, he offered them chocolate and ices. At 10:02, the Pope was approached by the Secretary of State, Cardinal Antonelli, who whispered something in his ear. The Pope's eyes were seen to fill with tears. He said goodbye to his guests and withdrew.
This was the news the Pope had received. The troops of King Victor Emmanuel II, who had been camped outside the city walls the night before, had made a breach in the old gate of Porta Pia and were at that moment pouring into Rome.
At the other end of the wall, the gate of St. John Lateran, almost off its hinges, was enveloped in flame. Pius waited for his generals to surrender. In a letter to the Committee for the Pontifical Defence, he had given strict instructions. Soon, a white flag was to be seen fluttering above the dome of St. Peter's. The papal states, the robe of Jesus Christ, as Pius called them, were gone forever. And with them, the visible signs of the temporal power of the papacy went 1,000 years of history.
Ever since his enforced exile at the beginning of his pontificate, Pius IX had adopted the citadel mentality. He was unable to reconcile the church and the modern world, to separate church and state. And so he chose isolation, withdrew into his fortress, becoming a self-styled prisoner of the Vatican. And for 60 years, no pope went outside the Vatican walls.
Pius IX reigned for 32 years, the longest pontificate in history. Pio Nono, as the Italians called him, was much loved for his piety, his simplicity, his sense of humour and his boundless charity, but more than anything, for his immense personal charm.
The culmination of the pontificate of Pius IX was without doubt the calling of the First Vatican Council. It opened on the 8th of December, 1869, in the presence of nearly 800 bishops from all over the world.
The council was scheduled to debate a comprehensive statement on the Church's teaching, but the most controversial issue was the question of papal infallibility, and when the political situation escalated, it was this which took precedence over all else.
A minority of bishops refused to vote for the decree, but rather than cause scandal, they left Rome the day before. On the 18th of July, in the midst of a violent thunderstorm, the council voted the Pope infallible.
The next day, war was declared between France and Prussia, and soon after, the council was adjourned sine die.
We, Pope Pius IX, adhering faithfully to the tradition received from the beginning of the Christian faith, teach and define as a dogma divinely revealed that the Roman pontiff, when he speaks ex cathedra, that is, when he defines a doctrine concerning faith or morals to be held by the universal church, is endowed with that infallibility with which the divine Redeemer has willed that his church should be equipped. If anyone shall presume, which God forbid, to contradict this our definition, let him be anathema.
You've been listening there to episode 41 of The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear episode 42 at this same time next week. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.